He was ostracised and isolated. They thought he was mad. In the Australian parlance, a complete nutter.
You know, there were people who called him a great American humorist within the profession.
That sound like anyone you know? Sound like maybe you? If so, you might be interested in today's show. We tell the story of two people whose lives, well, let's just say their lives did not proceed in a perfectly straight line.
From WNYC Studios, this is Freakonomics Radio, the show that explores the hidden side of everything. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
This episode was inspired by the economist Gary Becker, who died in 2014 at the age of 83. Since you listen to Freakonomics Radio, you may have heard of Becker, but most people probably haven't. He was born in 1930, grew up in Brooklyn. He was a good student. At 16, he faced an important decision: join the handball team or the math team. He was better at handball, but he chose math. He got into Princeton, where he studied economics, even though the fit wasn't quite right.
When I first started taking economics, I almost left it in my senior year because it seemed to me it didn't deal with important problems. Sociology, for example, did. And I tried thinking about sociology, but I finally decided it was a little too hard.
Well, he said that when he went to college, his interest was in the traditional subjects that sociologists study.
That's Richard Posner. He's a judge on the U.S. Court of Appeals in Chicago. He also teaches law at the University of Chicago. He and Becker were longtime friends.
But he thought that sociology was a weak field analytically, whereas economics had a great deal more rigor. And he thought that the methods of economics could be used to deal with sociological issues.
Becker went on to get his PhD in economics at the University of Chicago. He took a course with Milton Friedman, who was in the midst of redefining the field.
So 20 years earlier, economics meant, money and banking. It meant international trade. It meant finance. It meant a very clearly defined set of topics.
That's the Harvard economist Ed Glaser.
But there was no clear methodology. I mean, economics was as much moral philosophy as, modern social science during those early years. But there you have Friedman, who comes along and says, no, economics is about science. It's about science to do with human beings. And Becker, before anyone else sees the implication of that, which is, well, if it's about science applied to human beings, why do I have to work on money and banking? Why can't I work on something that seems like a more pressing social problem like discrimination?
I would tell myself, but it's so obvious that discrimination is such an important topic that economists don't see it. I mean, eventually they're going to have to see it.
So Becker's approach is what's called rational choice, since this is assumed that people are rational, trying to maximize their utility, or in other words, their welfare, their happiness, so forth, in all domains of life.
I think it's impossible to overstate how radical it was. There are famous stories that Becker told about people leaving the room when he was giving a seminar in a huff, saying, I thought this would be about price discrimination. So it's clear that this was something that was not at all treated with some degree of reverence, because it doesn't look or feel like economics.
It wasn't regarded as an economic field. And Gary was actually laughed at. He was rather bitter about the reception that his work had received.
Becker believed that any domain of human activity was worthy of an economist's scrutiny. So it wasn't just discrimination. He studied the economics of marriage and childbearing. He wrote a paper called A Theory on the Allocation of Time. At Harvard today, Ed Glaser still teaches a 1968 Gary Becker paper called Crime and Punishment, an Economic Approach. Here's how Glaser introduces the idea to his students.
We are all criminals, right? I certainly did not drive at 55 miles per hour all the way to work today, and I cannot promise that I have, you know, stopped at the red light on every street getting to this lecture. And I'm sure that all of us have things that we have violated to a greater or lesser degree. And I think that sort of respect shown for people who have chosen to violate the law is really crucial. And if you think about just how immediately obvious, you know, the power of that observation to solve the puzzle, the supposed puzzle of recidivism, the fact that, you know, you sent people to prison and then they decided to go back doing crime again. Well, if you have some view that they are sadly misinformed subhuman people who with a little bit of right thinking you can convince to go straight, well, that is a puzzle. But if you view criminals as being people who made a decision to undertake a particular profession, why should sending them off to be a guest of the state for a couple of years choose them to change that choice of profession? That's what made sense beforehand. It's what makes sense afterwards. And that's an immediate implication of this viewing criminals as being rational.
Becker had his supporters, but more common were the detractors, who thought his work lay somewhere between silly and worthless.
You know, there were people who called him a great American humorist within the profession. There's that famous article on the economics of brushing your teeth, which is clearly sort of mocking the Beckerian approach. So clearly there were people who, you know, for whatever reason, thought this was embarrassing to the profession or, you know, beneath what economists should be about. I think it probably stung him more than he would usually admit. I mean, Gary was not a let-it-all-hang-out kind of guy.
Becker preferred to keep his head down, do his work. He wasn't big on self-advocacy.
I was always a shy person, particularly when I was younger. So I wasn't one of these aggressive persons who went out there and was talking about everything they knew. It wasn't my nature.
What does the universe do with someone like this? Someone who's out there on his own, following his own off-kilter curiosities and sensibilities? You know what the universe does. It ridicules them or beats them up, maybe just ignores them. As we all know, if you want to get ahead in life, you have to color inside the lines. No excuses, no exceptions, no papers on the economics of crime, no more crazy ideas of any sort. Thank you very much.
They thought he was mad, in the Australian parlance, a complete nutter.
Around the time Gary Becker was getting beaten up for papers like On the Interaction Between the Quantity and Quality of Children, a young Australian doctor named Barry Marshall was just getting his career underway.
I think it's important to actually set the scene a little bit in terms of Barry and his personality.
That's Norman Swan. He's a renowned medical journalist in Australia who trained as an MD himself.
There's a word in Australian English, which is larrikin. And it just means somebody who's a bit of a lad who doesn't respect authority, but is honest and straight, but doesn't mind irritating people and annoying people. And that was Barry. He came from essentially a working class family, and he got into medicine, but he wasn't a star in medical school. He didn't win any medals. And then he started training as a specialist physician. To get his specialist exams, he needed to do a research project. And he was looking around for one, and he came across this shy, retiring, geeky pathologist called Robin Warren, who had noticed when he was doing biopsies of ulcers that there were these bacteria there. What were they doing there? But he needed some help. And just by happenstance, Barry was looking around for his research project, and this was a meeting made in heaven.
The notion that bacteria might be causing an intestinal illness seemed far-fetched. It had long been held that the gastric environment was too acidic for bacteria to thrive. They were thought to be incidental to the action. It is tempting in the modern age to think about medicine as a massive body of known, provable science. But the more one knows about medicine, the more one will acknowledge how much is not known, even about something as seemingly straightforward as the ulcer.
So all these ideas floating around. But as you know, Steve, the medicine is not very good on mechanism. Doctors post hoc invent mechanisms in many ways to explain phenomena that they see. And the mechanisms did not easily explain ulcer disease. So nobody had an idea really of what caused them.
At the time, ulcers weren't cured. They were merely treated or managed, not all that well.
So when I trained in medicine, there really was only one effective treatment if you had a gastric or duodenal ulcer, and it was surgery, where they cut nerves to the acid-producing areas of the stomach to reduce acid. And then they developed drugs which actually turned off the acid. And these were massive industries, not just for treating ulcers. Well, they didn't treat ulcers. They actually treated the symptoms and settled them down. But it was very hard to get ulcer healing. This was a multi-billion dollar international industry.
But Barry Marshall suspected that all this conventional wisdom might be wrong. He wondered if the ulcer, the foundation of a multi-billion dollar industry which didn't even cure it, if the ulcer were perhaps related to this squiggly bacteria that he and Robin Warren were studying. This bacteria came to be known as Helicobacter pylori. Marshall was working hard in the lab trying to learn the bacteria's properties.
Well, we did some animal experiments, but we could not make the human bacteria infect animals such as rats or pigs.
To Marshall, the next step was obvious.
So I said, I have to test it out on a human.
Feeding a potentially dangerous bacteria to human test subjects, not so easy. And therefore,
well, I decided that I was going to have to drink the bacteria myself. And I thought what would happen, I would just be having no symptoms for a few years, and then I'd have an ulcer, and then hallelujah, it'd be proven.
Marshall first had to make sure his own gut didn't already contain any of this bacteria. He asked a colleague to give him an endoscopy.
And I think he knew what was going on, but he said, as he put the scope down, he said, Barry, I'm not going to ask why I'm doing this. So he took some biopsies from me, and then they were all clear, no bacteria.
Marshall didn't tell anyone what he was about to do. Not his wife, not his research partner, Robin Warren.
If it was successful and I did develop an ulcer or stomach problems from the bacteria, that proved that they were harmful and possibly I was right, they could cause ulcers. But if nothing happened, that means that my 2 years of research by then was wasted.
Barry Marshall drank the bacteria. The 2 years, it turned out, were not wasted.
After about 5 days, I started having vomiting attacks. I had another endoscopy and the bacteria were everywhere. There were absolute millions of them in the lining of my stomach. So at that point, I'd proven the bacteria could infect a healthy person and cause gastritis.
Having studied the bacteria in the lab, Marshall knew what kind of antibiotic he could treat it with. So he took the antibiotic, quickly made himself well. Norman Swan again.
They'd done what they call now the killer experiment. I suppose in Barry's case, it almost was the killer experiment.
Barry Marshall had proved, at least to himself, that bacteria was the true cause of ulcers. So what happened now? Did the worldwide medical community immediately hoist Marshall on their shoulders and praise his breakthrough? No, they didn't. His research was ridiculed, dismissed, badmouthed.
He wasn't from the establishment. He wasn't one of them. He'd made this discovery before he'd even got his specialist qualifications. He wasn't a card-carrying researcher. And Barry's a bit odd. Barry's, he's odd. He's very amusing. He's remarkably candid and outgoing. He can be quite manic. And he would present and people would think, who's this nutter? And then there was this question in their mind that if he was selling it this hard in this kind of odd way, was there something fishy about the research? So that was, if you like, the subtext that people didn't quite articulate, but it was certainly there. And regardless of his finding, because he wasn't credible, because he just wasn't one of them, he was rough and ready. And then the pharmaceutical industry found every angle they could to oppose it.
And how did he respond?
Well, I think Barry just got angrier and angrier. So in other words, he didn't tailor his message to the boys. You know, he wasn't a good old boy sat around a table. You know, he wasn't going to tailor his message. The message was the message, and he just kept on banging away at it and didn't compromise.
And which must have made him seem even more of a nutter to his opponents, yes?
I think so.
Coming up on Freakonomics Radio, are these outsiders doomed for lifelong despair?
People would always say, Dr. Marshall, do you feel vindicated? Well, we won, but we knew we were going to win. We knew we were going to win because we had the truth.
And what do medieval nuns and Bo Jackson have in common? That's coming up on Freakonomics Radio.
From WNYC Studios, this is Freakonomics Radio. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
Today we've heard the stories of Barry Marshall and Gary Becker, one a doctor, the other an economist. They both followed their own light and paid for it. In each case, the establishment treated them like rank outsiders. What's encouraging is that they lived to see their reputations rehabilitated, their ideas celebrated. It would have been so much more likely for them to die broken and bitter in the wilderness, utterly unrecognized. That is a risk taken by people who work outside the system, who challenge the conventional wisdom. Like Barry Marshall, the Australian gastroenterologist who had the audacity to suggest that he had found a cure for ulcers, even though the medical establishment didn't believe him. Here's the Australian doctor journalist Norman Swan.
Medicine chose to ignore it. They chose to ignore it because it didn't suit their prejudices, because they didn't quite like the way the messenger was selling it, and because of a huge marketing push by a very influential industry, which told them it was bull.
But after years and years of promoting his theory and of being ridiculed for it, Marshall finally, in 1994, saw his findings accepted by the National Institute of Health.
People would always say, Dr. Marshall, do you feel vindicated? Well, we won, but we knew we were going to win. We knew we were going to win because we had the truth.
If you look at the history of medicine, it's interesting how long it takes for evidence to get into the thick skulls of doctors. So when Pasteur proved the germ theory of disease, it took about 30 years for the medical profession around the world to accept the germ theory of disease. Amazingly, it took 20 odd years for doctors to accept that aspirin reduced the risk of dying of coronary heart disease after you've had a heart attack. And it was well proven. It took 20 odd years for doctors to accept that. It takes a long time. It's a very conservative profession. It takes a long time to convince them of new ideas. And this was no different because it was so radically outside what they were expecting.
Radical indeed. Barry Marshall and Robin Warren's work proved not only that Helicobacter pylori was the true cause of ulcers, but of stomach cancer as well. In 2005, more than 20 years after Marshall swallowed that batch of bacteria, they were awarded the Nobel Prize.
It's very rare in medicine to find a cure for anything. This is a rare example, a really rare example in modern medicine of a cure rather than an effective treatment. So what they had before was an effective treatment. It was expensive, it was for life, and here was something which got rid of the disease. And it got rid of the disease pretty cheaply.
I asked Norman Swan what the story of Barry Marshall and Robin Warren could teach the rest of us.
I think the generalizable takeaway from Barry and Robin's discovery and the resistance to it is that people should judge things on their scientific merit and not shoot the messenger. And to make a discovery like this probably does take somebody who's out of the ordinary. And somebody who's out of the ordinary may not communicate in the way that we expect or have become used to amongst our colleagues. And therefore, we really do need to go back to the science.
And what about Gary Becker, the rogue economist who led off today's program? He thought his field should look beyond finance and banking and consider all of human behavior, from racial discrimination to mate picking. Well, Becker, too, after years of being marginalized, was ultimately celebrated. Time caught up to his way of thinking. Becker, too, won a Nobel Prize in 1992, and in 2007, the Presidential Medal of Freedom. How did he feel about the Nobel? Here's his friend, Judge Richard Posner.
Well, he was pleased. I think he felt it was overdue. He should have gotten it earlier. That's a standard reaction to these things.
And Harvard economist Ed Glaser, who studied with Gary Becker and still teaches his work.
Becker is different from many of the, you know, wilderness years type scientists that we think of, in the sense that he was not somebody who came out of nowhere, who had a brilliant idea and was mocked for it initially. He was someone who was part of a very well-established economics department, who had, you know, early respect, early rewards in lots of different ways. But what's different from many of us is that he didn't in any sense rest on those. Here is a guy who over and over again, you know, decided to take those risks, to court disaster, to be on the very edge, to go into rooms, to enter fields in which he knew that people were going to think that he was outrageous. He knew that people were going to denigrate his work, and yet he still did it. And that's what made him so productive. And I think the challenge for all of us, particularly all of us who are in the idea business, is that it's a reminder that we should actually try to push ourselves as much as possible to be different, to be unpopular often, to do things that are troubling to the status quo, that risk us being thought of as being, you know, less than we are. And I think that's the Becker lesson, is it's trying to be an outsider almost by design.
Coming up after the break, what does it really mean to cut off your nose to spite your face? And more important, why do we so often do it?
All right, so I don't even know what spite is. What is spite?
From WNYC Studios, this is Freakonomics Radio with your host, Stephen Dubner.
It probably was pretty darn painful because you're not living in a world with good razors. The chances are what they're using is kitchen cutlery, I would imagine, and that is not necessarily all that sharp. And I can't imagine how painful it was.
Lisi Oliver was a linguist at Louisiana State University specializing in medieval law. She died in 2015. We spoke with her a couple years earlier. What do you think Oliver was talking about that was so darn painful?
Between the 5th and the 12th century in early modern Europe, barbarity swept through the continent and also the island of England, and often the targets of these attacks were monasteries and nunneries. But nunneries, you had the added incentive of rape to add to sort of pillage and destruction.
For a nun, rape was especially problematic, aside from the obvious reasons. Rape violated a nun's chastity, which meant that as a bride of Christ, she might be forbidden entry into heaven. So what do you do if you are a nun and there are barbarians at the gate? In the 9th century, one nun, an abbess who came to be known as Saint Ebba, came up with a plan. Here's Lisi Oliver reading from a history by Roger of Wendover.
The abbess, with an heroic spirit, took a razor and with it cut off her nose, together with her upper lip onto the teeth, presenting herself a horrible spectacle to those who stood by. Filled with admiration at this admirable deed, the whole assembly followed her maternal example and severally did the like to themselves. When this was done, together with the morrow's dawn, the pagan attackers came. On beholding the abbess and the sisters so outrageously mutilated and stained with their own blood from the sole of their foot unto their head, they retired in haste from the place. Their leaders ordered their wicked followers to set fire and burn the monastery with all its buildings and its holy inmates. Which being done by these workers of iniquity, the holy abbess and all the most holy virgins with her attained the glory of martyrdom. There's a very graphic picture of St. Ebba cutting her nose and lip off and all of the women around her looking thrilled at the concept. In terms of pain, it must have just been dreadful to cut your nose off at night and then wait until the morning with that pain racking your body. But that is the pain of martyrdom. It's the crown of thorns.
Now, why are we telling you this grisly tale? Because I want to talk about why people sometimes hurt others even when it's costly to themselves, otherwise known as spite, as in cutting off your nose to spite your face. Scholars aren't certain, but this phrase likely originates with the practice of medieval nuns like St. Ebba, women who mutilated themselves in an attempt to preserve their chastity. Now, economics is all about trade-offs. Everything has a cost and a benefit. It struck me that spite is, in some ways, an economic concept. So I called up an economist I know, Steve Levitt. He's my Freakonomics friend and co-author, teaches at the University of Chicago.
So when I think about spite as an economist, the way I would think of spite is that it is the response of an individual who has been wronged in some way by another, who then is willing in the future to pay a large cost in order to punish the person who wronged him in the first place. So in a strange sense, it's not a very economic concept because in general, we don't think that people are going to be overly willing to pay a lot of costs themselves to punish other people.
Yeah, I think what you described is more revenge than spite, though.
All right, so I don't even know what spite is. What is spite?
Excellent question. Well, it's not so easy indeed to define spite.
That's Benedikt Herrmann. He's also an economist, originally from Germany. Now he works as a policy officer for the European Commission. He's done a lot of research on antisocial behavior. You might, in fact, call him a scholar of spite.
Let's have an easy start here and define spite as a behavior where an individual is ready to harm him or herself at own cost, to harm somebody else without creating anything good for a third party, for anyone outside. Because you could sometimes be nasty to somebody just because he or she has misbehaved and you would like to do it in a kind of educational way, which then I would not call spite.
Mm, because it's not costing you anything.
No, if I'm punishing somebody who has misbehaved to the community, to our group, if I punish him or her at own cost, it could look like spite, but it's not spite because it's an educational momentum. You try to get somebody who has done something bad to behave better in the future. So it's a kind of moralistic way of punishing, a moralistic way of being aggressive. And so it's not the kind of spite I'm after. I'm after the kind of behavior where somebody would harm others with for no reason, for no moral reason, apart from something that might satisfy him or herself only.
Traditional economics argues that most people try to satisfy their self-interest, to maximize their profits and opportunities. Economists have a name for this model of self-interest, homo economicus. But within that framework, spite is a bit puzzling. Why would someone pay outsized costs for no benefit other than to hurt someone else? Well, Benedikt Herrmann thinks that the idea of homo economicus is a bit archaic. He prefers a different term.
Homo rivalis, yes, indeed.
Homo rivalis. Meaning that humans are driven at our core by competition rather than simple self-interest. Homo economicus wants to get as much as possible for himself. Homo rivalis just wants to make sure he gets more than the other guy. In other words, as much as we like to think that we are absolute animals, we are, in fact, relative animals. Now, we know this in part through the experimental games that economists like to play. One of the classics is called the ultimatum game. Here's Steve Levitt again.
So the ultimatum game is a little experimental game that the behavioral economists have developed, in which two players come into the lab and they're completely anonymous. They'll never meet each other. It's a one-shot game. And one player is given, say, $10, and they're allowed to divide that $10 however they'd like between themselves and the other player. That other player is then informed about the way in which the division has occurred and is given a choice. They can either accept the division, say $7 for the person who's splitting the pot and $3 for me, or I have another option to say, no, I prefer both of us to get zero. Okay, so what you always face a choice between as the recipient of the ultimatum is I can accept what the other person offered me, or I can have us both get zero. And empirically, what we see is that rarely will anyone accept an offer that's less than 20%. So if the person who splits the pot divides it more unevenly than 75-25, you're almost guaranteed to have it rejected, even though the rejector is giving up the 25 or the 20% of their own money in order to take the 75 or the 80% away from you.
Now, to an economist, this might seem perplexing. Why am I willing to throw away two or three of my dollars just to make sure that you don't get seven or eight? Well, maybe it's because I feel you've wronged me by splitting the pot so unevenly. But remember what Benedict Herman said earlier about spite. True spite, as he sees it, is not motivated by a desire to punish someone's bad behavior. So he wanted to see how people behave absent such a moral incentive. He and a colleague came up with an experiment.
So let me quickly try to explain here on the radio how this experiment worked. So you would be invited to our experiment like many other students. You don't know each other. You come to our lab inside. You have to sit behind computers. You are requested not to talk with anyone during the whole experiment.
So you're paired with another player, but you don't see that person. You each get $10, and then you're given an option. If you surrender $1 of your money, you can destroy $5 of the other person's wealth. Now, there's no revenge going on here. There wouldn't seem to be anything for you to gain by destroying the other person's money. But as Benedict Herman found, about 10% of the players did take that option. Herman calls such a player a difference maximizer.
That means that we want to maximize the payoff differential between the opponent and us. So maybe in a more picturesque way, being aware that we are losing our trousers for the sake and for the hope that the opponent will lose both the shirt and the trousers.
In other words, some people were always willing to cut off their noses to spite the other player. Herman was perplexed by this finding, and he tried the experiment in a variety of versions, variety of settings, different parts of the world, different kinds of societies. But in each case, he found that a surprising number of people would give up some of what was theirs for the sole purpose of taking something away from someone else.
And what are you as the researcher thinking? Are you thinking this is remarkably surprising, sad, strange, irrational? What is your – I mean, on the one hand, you must be excited because for the sake of a paper, it's a fascinating finding.
This exactly – these are the two souls of a researcher. Of course, on the one side, exactly as you – this side said it very nicely. You are very excited. But on the other side, of course, you start thinking, oh, my God, who the heck are we? Mm. We, the humans. For me, the outcome of all this research is definitely a kind of sadness and also worry that we can be too fast, we humans, we can get too fast into intergroup conflict, which don't make any sense to anyone. That we start to harm each other, that we start innocent people to kill each other for something that at the end of the day could have been decided in a much more reasonable way.
Now, as interesting as this may be, as believable as it may be, Steve Levitt warns us not to make too much of lab experiments like these. It's hard to extrapolate from a lab setting to the hurly-burly of the real world.
When people are in the lab, they're completely anonymous. It's the only time we'll ever play. But the real world isn't usually like that.
The real world has more options. The real world has bigger stakes. especially in a realm like professional sports.
Exactly what he's doing.
Spider-Man!
Dave O'Connor makes films for Radical Media in New York. He was the executive producer of an ESPN documentary called You Don't Know Bo. The Bo in question is Bo Jackson.
Bo was probably the single greatest athlete of his generation. Two sports star, football and baseball, and was just a transformative athlete. And he just physically, there's something about his presence that feels different than normal human beings.
Is it a bird? Is it a plane? It's Super Bowl!
In the spring of 1986, Bo Jackson was playing his senior year of college baseball at Auburn.
He showed signs of being a very highly valued Major League Baseball player.
I'm tearing the cover off the ball. I'm batting over 400. Oh, I don't know how many home runs I was sitting on then.
That's Jackson himself from the film. Now, he had just completed his senior season of college football, which had gone even better. Dave O'Connor again.
Football, his senior year, is one of the all-time great seasons of a running back in college football. He rushes for nearly 1,800 yards. He wins the Heisman Trophy and basically enshrines himself as a legend of college football. Sort of the common wisdom was that Bo will be the number one draft pick in football. He will probably not play baseball at all. And if he does, somebody should pick him in the 20th round or 30th round on a flyer just in case.
Right. You don't want to waste a pick on a guy who's going to be playing football.
Right.
So while finishing up his college baseball career, Jackson starts getting courted by NFL teams. The football draft happens before the baseball draft. The number one overall NFL pick is held by the Tampa Bay Buccaneers, who are owned by a man named Hugh Culverhouse. The Bucs have made it clear that they want Bo Jackson.
I was all gung-ho, and I had taken a few trips to visit some teams my senior year. I got the okay to go visit Tampa Bay. Hugh Culverhouse sent his jet to Columbus Airport, drove over, got on the jet, went to Tampa Bay for my visit. It was almost like a college visit when you're a high school senior and you're going to visit a college and they get some of the players to show you around town, to show you the night spots, take you to a nice restaurant and entertain you. About 4 or 5 days later, I'm back at Auburn getting ready for my baseball game. And as I get to the gate to come around the dugout, Coach Baird approaches me. And so he said, Bo, can I talk to you for a second? So we go behind the dugout. And I'm thinking that he's going to tell me, hey, some big league team wants to sign me. And he said, did you take a trip last week on Hugh Culverhouse's jet to go down to visit Tampa? I said, yes, and the folks checked with the NCAA and said that it was okay to do that. He said, well, Bo, somebody didn't check, and the NCAA has declared you ineligible for any more college sports, so you can't play baseball no more. And I sit there on that ground, and I cried like a baby. I cried like a baby.
Bo Jackson immediately felt that he'd been wronged. He loved baseball, and even though it looked like he was going to play football professionally, he was distraught about being barred from finishing out his college baseball career. And what's more, he became convinced that Hugh Culverhouse, the Tampa Bay owner, had done this to Bo on purpose.
Because the officials at Tampa Bay told me personally, yes, we checked, and they said that it was okay. I think it was all a plot now just to get me ineligible from baseball because they saw the season that I was having, and they thought that they were going to lose me to baseball. And if we declare him ineligible, then we got him.
Now, we don't know whether the Bucks actually meant for this to happen, but it certainly did seem to work out well for them. They were in line to pick Bo Jackson number one in the NFL draft and pay him so much money that he'd forget about baseball in a heartbeat. It was just one problem. Bo Jackson isn't the forgetting type.
And I said, there is no way I'm signing with Tampa Bay. And I told Hugh Coverhouse, I said, you draft me if you want. You're going to waste a draft pick. I said, I promise you that. And Hugh Coverhouse, well, this is what I'm going to offer you as a signing bonus, and you're going to take it whether you want it or not. I said, all right. They didn't think I was serious. I talked to my baseball coach. I said, coach, a lot of people don't think I'm serious about playing baseball. I said, but if Tampa Bay drafts me, I said, on my honor, and I'm looking you in your eye, man to man, I'm playing baseball. So if you know any teams out there that's interested in an outfielder, you let them know.
In the NFL draft that April, Tampa Bay did select Bo Jackson with the number one pick, which was attached to a $7.66 million 5-year contract. And then, a couple of months later, Bo Jackson was selected in the baseball draft, in the fourth round, by the Kansas City Royals. They offered him 3 years at just $1 million. The choice would seem obvious, but Bo doesn't know obvious. He rejects a football offer, and he takes the baseball offer. How surprising is this? Here's Dave O'Connor again.
Unprecedented. It just doesn't happen. You can't... I mean, money talks, right? I mean, you have $7.6 million sitting there, and you sign a contract for one. That's a rare occurrence.
It sounds like a decision that very few people that I know, at least, would have made. Do you think that was an act of spite on Bo Jackson's part?
It's interesting because I think Bo would say that he did the honorable thing and that he has a code. But when you look at it on its surface, it is spite. There is no rational explanation for walking away from that kind of money. He's not just hurting himself here. He's also doing this to hurt Tampa Bay. The opportunity cost of losing a first-round draft pick isn't just that Bo Jackson isn't playing on my team. It's that every other player I could have selected with that pick is not playing on my team either. So it's a huge impact to Tampa Bay, not to mention the public relations nightmare of going out on a limb and selecting somebody and not getting him.
So Jackson does sign with the Royals. He starts the year in the minor leagues, but by the end of the season, he makes a major league team. He's on track for a nice baseball career. And then the next year, he becomes eligible to re-enter football. Now, will he play? Nobody knows. But the Los Angeles Raiders draft him in the seventh round. He signs, and suddenly he's playing two professional sports. At the end of the baseball season, he jumps straight into football, and he became a star in both.
Bo knows basketball, too.
All right, so we agree that Bo Jackson's athletic career turned out pretty well, remarkable on some dimensions, but overall not one of the greatest ever because it wasn't long enough, perhaps. We agree that because he was such an unusual athlete in two sports, he became this icon and the focus of a remarkable and probably quite remunerative ad campaign, right? We agree on this so far?
Yes.
Do we therefore agree that had this catastrophe not happened with him, with getting drafted for the NFL by a team that out of spite or something like spite he turned down, that if that had not happened, that all the rest may not have happened?
Yeah, I think that's a plausible argument to make because he probably, had he signed that deal with Tampa Bay, if he doesn't get injured, he probably becomes one of the best running backs in NFL history. But that's probably it.
I mean, honestly, my takeaway lesson here is spite pays.
Yeah, you would say, I mean, if you take a look at where he ends up, spite certainly paid in his case.
Thank you.
So here's a question worth thinking about. If spite indeed exists, is it something that we humans have always carried around in our genetic code, or do we pick it up along the way?
We're a very biological organism, and we've inherited an awful lot. In fact, most of the basic emotions that guide us from our animal and Paleolithic early human past.
That is E.O. Wilson. He's a renowned biologist and author.
And that's Catherine Wells, who helped produce this episode. Catherine, you had a chat with Professor Wilson, yes?
I did. It was cool. So I called him up because I wanted to know where all of this self-destructive spite comes from. You know, is this a common behavior throughout nature, or are we unusual in it? And I have to say that I just assumed that we would be the meanest creatures in existence, given everything we've heard today. But Wilson said that wasn't true.
Oh, no, we only moderately mean.
Now, E.O. Wilson has done a lot of thinking about the origins of human behavior, and he thinks the nastiness that we see in animals might give us a clue to why we act the way we do.
I mean, things that you really don't want to think about too much before you go to sleep, and you might have nightmares. But here's the story about spite. If we define spite as doing harm to someone else at the cost of harm to yourself, and that involves a surrender of some advantage or emotional reward on your part, you give it up in order to hurt somebody else. That might not exist.
In nature.
And it's very difficult to find any case in the great encyclopedia of animal aggression where it doesn't give some advantage to the individual doing the aggression. But it's very rare that an animal would deliberately injure itself just in order to create injury in another individual without any further gain to itself to deliberately do that. I think spite does not exist in the animal kingdom. Now,
in the way that it does in humans. Is
well,
that right?
Let's take humans. When a person injures himself or herself, say in reputation, in diminishing wealth, causing their own early death, whatever it is, in order to harm another person, you would say, oh, that's spite. That's got to be spite. But it really would be true spite in my mind, as opposed to mere risk-taking or trade-off for one kind of gain in exchange for one kind of loss taken, if you can't see a gain. And that's hard to imagine. Even vengeance has its gain. It has a strong emotional award. For example, if you harm yourself and your reputation by vicious gossip, by manipulation, by cheating, whatever, you accept that if the damage you can do benefits you in some other way or benefits, say, particularly your own offspring in a particular way, you know, like unscrupulous stage moms, murderesses of cheerleading champion competitors. I think you get the drift. Even a mass murderer who goes out and harms a lot of people is taking some benefit, emotional benefit from that when suicide is intended. It's a lot of mass murders are just a terrible form of suicide in which a person decides to get the satisfaction in advance of committing it. And maybe the satisfaction the person will get in striking out against something they imagine to have been their enemy and diminished them before. So when you add that factor, maybe real spite does not exist.
So I don't know whether this is a relief or not. I mean, the idea that spite might not even exist seems good, but the fact that we get personal satisfaction out of hurting other people? I told Wilson that was kind of a bummer.
That just shows you're not a psychopath.
I'm a total wuss. But here's the upside. Spite is not the only motivation we have for being self-destructive. There's actually another. Altruism. When we hurt ourselves, we aren't always doing it just to hurt someone else. Sometimes we're doing it to help.
One of the things that makes us human is our internally conflicted nature, confliction, our ambivalence to our own selves. We are constantly wrestling with our conscience and with a tendency to deviate from social norms in a risky way and to do wrong, to be selfish. The contest within us between doing the moral thing, even the heroic thing on one side, and doing the selfish, perhaps even criminal thing on the other side, that contest is what gives us such a continuously conflicted nature. If we went and became completely altruistic, then we would be like ants. If we went to the opposite extreme and had complete lack of constraint and it was complete individualism, then we would have chaos. We would not have order. The group would dissolve. So we have to be in the middle. This appears to be the human condition.
It's funny listening to him talk about that.
That's Steve Levitt again. He took a class with Wilson when he, Levitt, was an undergrad at Harvard. He's very fond of the way Wilson thinks.
There could be no two disciplines closer than evolutionary biology and economics. And they studied different questions and they used different methods. But the way that evolutionary biologists think is exactly like the way that economists think. Both are very much a model of behavior, of individual behavior, an individual behavior that's motivated by costs and benefits. The other thing is that at its heart, both economics and evolutionary biology strive for simplicity, that the simplest story, which can explain a set of facts, is the one that we gravitate to, as opposed to other disciplines, history. History is all about complexity. And, you know, literature is all about complexity. Even sociology, I think, at heart, is about complexity. But economics is about simplicity.
Like E.O. Wilson, Levitt thinks that spite, true spite, may not really exist. Because that would mean that I hurt you even though I get nothing for it. Nothing. And while it may seem that I get nothing, I probably get something.
What I would say about spite, I would say this, to know that an act is spite, you have to be inside the head of the perpetrator, because the idea of spite is that it's being done without benefit. But it's interesting because one of the first premises of economics is you can never really know what other people are thinking and why they're doing what they're doing. Instead, we focus on what they do. And so consequently, my view is forget about what's going on inside of other people's heads. You'll probably never know what it is. And focus on what they're actually doing.
Do you see altruism as sort of the flip side of the coin to spite and therefore not quite real?
Altruism is exactly the flip side of spite in the sense that there are acts which very well could be altruistic, but equally could be done in a perfectly self-interested way. Both make you feel really good, and it feels good to help other people sometimes, and it feels so good to punish other people who've wronged you. So I think they're both actually completely consistent with the idea of people doing the best they can.
And what about you personally, Levitt? Do you get more satisfaction generally from helping people or punishing people?
I'm a lover, not a fighter. You know that, don't you? I like to help people.
I'm Stephen Dubner, and that was Freakonomics Radio. Thanks for listening. We will be back next week. If you just can't wait that long, you can get our entire Freakonomics Radio podcast archive at freakonomics.com or at iTunes, where you can also subscribe.